You are listening to a follow-up interview with indie comics creator Troy Hickman. Troy Hickman created Twilight Guardian at Top Cow, and in this interview we discussed that series in depth, which of course touches on all sorts of other subjects. Troy's a big fan of Silver Age comic books, and we go into that a little bit, as well as the themes discussed in Twilight Guardian, and so much more. We're doing this interview in two parts. Part one focusing mostly on Twilight Guardian, and part two coming soon, where we go off on all sorts of interesting tangents. So keep an eye on the blog for that. But for now, on to the interview. I just finished rereading Twilight Guardian in a single setting. I read it as it was coming out in single issues, but I really liked how it read in one chunk like that.
Yeah, I wish I could get everyone to, to read it that way. I couldn't even get my girlfriend to do that, unfortunately.
Did you write it when you were writing the series? Were you writing it with the single issues in mind, or were you just thinking 22 page chunks? I got to do however X amount of pages for one story.
Yeah, if we're just talking the miniseries, I plotted it out in its entirety all at one time. And, you know, it's one of those things where, as with pretty much everything that I do, I try to write it in such a way that it can stand alone as individual issues. But, yeah, I mean, it obviously has to work to some extent as a miniseries, and I think that's the way that it does work best. It's because there are so many things in there that I tried to connect from one issue to another. That's what I'm shooting for. This is probably why comics eventually, you know, have come into this whole, where so many people refer to them as graphic novels and the like, because they're, to some extent, they've become more novel-like probably in that respect. From the time that we started having more continuing storylines to today, where it seems like almost everything is set up to be sort of an arc. That's what I was shooting for. And hopefully given what I was trying to do with it, I would almost have to think that it works better if you can sit down and read it all at one time, which would be like a really long bathroom break. And I would not recommend that.
Or you can do single issues and eat lots of fiber.
Well, that probably should be the slogan for the book.
You can use it for a blurb on the softback when it's released. I give you my permission. So I don't know if anybody listening to this has already listened to the, cause this is a follow-up interview we're doing. We did talk at length when issue one came out. So maybe just to refresh people on what Twilight Guardian is, for maybe somebody who hasn't picked it up yet, might be considering getting the trade, if you can give us a basic synopsis, and then we can maybe get into more details issue by issue.
Okay, let's see how quickly I can do this. Basic premise of the book, if I were trying to sell this to an editor, Twilight Guardian is a woman, possibly has some mental issues. She, every night, she puts on a hoodie and a mask. She goes and patrols a 9-block area around her neighborhood. She thinks of herself in terms of being a superhero. With the 4-issue series, we find that her ex-boyfriend has disappeared. So there's a mystery angle. I don't know really what to tell you beyond that. Each issue kind of explores sort of different things. There's a lot of themes to the book.
Well, at the end, we'll start with issue one. At the end of issue one, because that basically what you've recapped there, we get, or at least an overview in issue one, the loss of her boyfriend, something's up with her father, and that sort of thing. mental illness issues, possibly it's ambiguous. What's the big event in issue one is when she gets invited to attend a meeting of the Real Superhero League of America. And in issue two, I enjoyed this because it allowed me to live vicariously what it's like to go at a convention, because I've never been to one, being far away from any of the major conventions. One thing that I found was interesting was that you, or at least that's how I read it, you use it as an opportunity to comment on fans of comic books and the scene.
Yeah, to some extent. I've excuse me. The book, the nature of Twilight Guardian herself, the kind of person that she is, actually, you know, sort of stems from just such things. It's, as I think I may have said last time, one of the themes of the book is the nature of, you know, what we consider mental illness to be and how we choose to define that. And, you know, some of the way that I've grown to look at this is because of the time that I've spent at comic conventions and comic shops and doing signings and things like that. You meet a lot of really fascinating people and a lot of folks who would be considered at the very least eccentric to a lot of the general public. And the question becomes, these are all people who, most of them are very bright folks. They have lives and they seem very functional, but a lot of them are, you know, there's kind of a fringe element sometimes where there seems to be almost like a disconnect. So I'll have people coming up to my tables at conventions and really saying some odd things. And the question there becomes is, you know, are these people within the realm of what we would consider quote unquote sane people? I would say yes, but I guess it's debatable. So that kind of came out of that. I think in the second issue, I think I'm pretty accurate with the way that comic fans act. And I think overall, we'd probably consider them fairly normal people. I would say that the depiction of the convention itself is fairly accurate for you know, folks who have not been to conventions before. This one's a little odd because I have it set in on Madeline Island in Wisconsin. And a lot of people ask about that. Well, why would you have it set there? It's, if you're familiar with the area, it's a tiny little place. And it's basically just this little island that you have to get to by like a ferry in Wisconsin. I did it because I wanted to have the pun, you know, that it was the Madeline Con, which is probably the worst way to go about writing comics. But most of the things that I write come from puns and the like. So that's why it happened there. But it worked out really well that the convention was set there, because I was able to sort of draw this analogy between what she's going through as a human being, you know, this sort of loneliness that she's feeling, and that goes away for a while when she meets with this group of real-life superheroes. And because it's set on an island, I'm able to kind of draw a comparison to that the way she normally feels is almost like as if she's on an island. Which is that kind of disconnect that I talked about, you know, with fans and the like. Sometimes there's something that sets people apart, and you know, this could be part of that. But I was happy with the way that the convention turned out. It was a very top cow heavy convention, by the way. If you look around the issue, there's Top Cow stuff everywhere.
Yes, I think I guess the same thing. There's a lot of Witchblade stuff. Darkness, Velocity, a couple of some of the pilot seasons.
Sure. So,
for the Top Cow fans who are looking for Easter eggs, I that must be gratifying.
I like to think that maybe in the Twilight Guardians universe, maybe Top Cow is the number one company, which would also mean I'd sell a lot more copies, which would be great.
She meets here with the Real Life Superhero League of America, and you introduce a few interesting characters. And I know that you've developed an interest, or at least an affinity for the real-life superhero, I suppose, movement. Did you base any of these characters on people you've come across in that group of people, or did you just pull these out from thin air?
Yeah, it's actually a combination of both. There are characters in there. There's the sort of the leader of the group, the Vermilion Claw, who is based on the Crimson Fist, who I've become fairly close to, who's a real life superhero. Most of the rest of them are sort of a I tried to sort of encompass the entirety of the real life superhero community, because it's, even though functionally they're doing kind of the same things, they're not a monolithic group. There are some of them, I would say probably the majority of them, spend most of their time not fighting crime and that sort of stuff, but doing public service kind of things. So that they're going around and they're giving food or toiletries or whatever to the homeless, or they might be walking women to their cars in parking lots at night, that kind of thing. All, in my opinion, tremendously heroic things in and of themselves.
This
But
is one of the themes that I noticed that you explore, and it gets into it further in the series, is what makes a hero.
sure, no, absolutely, and it's one of the most fascinating things for me is, after having first the pilot season issue and then these four issues, the response that I've heard from people about the kind of book that it is. And it's interesting, because people go into it expecting to read it as a superhero book, and it is a superhero book, but they tend to look at it in the way that conventionally I think we've sort of been trained to look at superheroes. And so I get some really interesting reactions from people. And that's kind of fascinated me in and of itself. I think there's all sorts of things that I can probably write about from this point on, simply from what I've gained from that, that sort of wisdom. But yeah, that's very, very much part of the nature of the book. And with the real life superhero people, it's interesting, because, as I said, I mean, they're kind of a conglomeration of different sorts of heroes who do this, who put on costumes and, try to make a difference in the world. And there are different, there are some who actually do try to get more, into the maybe a little bit more conventional kind of superhero realm, where maybe they are actually trying to run, drug dealers out of their neighborhood or something like that. That tends to be a little bit rarer, simply because it is dangerous. But it does happen. But yeah, the question becomes, and this is what fascinates me about the real life superhero movement or community or whatever you want to call it, is what has moved these people to do this. And I've had the chance to interview some of these guys, and it's really quite fascinating. I mean, it's sort of like if you've read Watchmen, and hopefully most everybody listening to this has read Watchmen, what Alan Moore talked about in there, we got a sense of, here are all these superheroes, and almost every one of them has a different reason why they became a superhero. And what I have found is there's a lot of similarity to that in the real life superhero community. Although I do think that the sort of thread that combines them all is the fact that most of them are very altruistic and are doing this for the right reasons. So.
At the end of issue two, Twilight is approached by a stranger who appeared to have been stalking her, but turns out is the comics publisher, and he proposes to turn or take her life story, or at least her exploits as a real-life superhero, and turn them into a comic book. And you use this device, this literary device, in what I interpret to be a meta-textual thing, where Twilight becomes a comic book character in the comic, in the Twilight Guardian comic book. So it gets a little naughty, I suppose, it with a K. And in this issue, you use, we actually see the different pitches that were made to Avernus Comics about Twilight Guardian's life turned into a comic book. And you use, you seem to use the opportunity to parody, or at least tribute or homage to different genres of comic books.
Yeah, it's the way that issue three is set up is that, yes, she gets three different pitches from the company, just like two pages each, so she can get a feel for what it would be like if it were done in this particular style. And yeah, I don't know what you would call those exactly. I mean, obviously, in all the issues, I have her reading comics, and they tend to be things that are, you know, the comics that she reads. And so they're usually Silver Age type stuff. That's the stuff that she's really interested in. In issue three, what we see are three types of comics that are currently popular and what her character would be like if she were in them. So, you know, it becomes an issue of, because Twilight Guardian itself, the miniseries, is my attempt to do something really different from most of the mainstream comics, the superhero comics now, this becomes, you know, well, had I done it in the way that, that most comics are done now, what might it be like? So you get, you know, you get the sort of violent vigilante character, sort of a Punisher sort of character.
Which Bananas Froster makes an appearance in. Excellent role he plays. He drops a bomb.
Well, actually that character, even though he's got Bananas Froster like characters, he's supposed to be a version of her sock monkey, Midnight.
Oh, I see. Yeah, he's got an M on the headband there.
Yeah, because in her, in a strange sort of way, in her mind, even though he never leaves the house, she has dressed him in a costume now,
right.
She sort of looks at him as her sidekick. So. He does appear there. He's a much different, and technically, I'm not even sure in the panel. He doesn't really look like a monkey. He looks like he's probably an ape of some kind.
Right.
So you got that sort of violent sort of thing. You know, I've got a, in that one, there's like the Punisher takes on like Jigsaw. So I did a character, the villain is called the Jart, and he's a guy with a jart sticking out of his head. Which you couldn't do these days because little kids don't play with jarts anymore. They're not allowed to. He would get nerfed in the head, which wouldn't do particular harm. And then the second one is done sort of Vertigo style. It's done the way that a British writer might do the comic. Lots of mentions of arse and that wonderful kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then the third one is done sort of like the cosmic epic kind of thing where every possible character appears, and somehow, even though she has no real superpowers, Twilight Guardian saves the day, and you know, that kind of stuff.
Right. I'm curious, Troy. Have you come across any fans of these genres which you poked fun at, who were possibly upset at you kind of making fun of the genre they like?
No, actually, I don't think I've heard from anyone that had any problem with those sorts of things. And I think the reason for that is the audience that I'm shooting for, it may not unfortunately be a large audience, but I think the people who are going to read Twilight Guardian and stick with it through the four issues are going to be people who are fairly, you know, on the ball about these things.
Right.
So they're not going to take offense to that, even if they like those kind of comics, and that's fine if they do.
Yeah.
I think they can look at this and say, okay, this is just poking a little bit of fun.
Yeah, because I'm a fan of all these genres, and I had a riot with this with these characters. One of them is, what is Sloterdamerung?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, wonderfully convoluted plot here that you conjured up for that multiversal chaos or mayhem or whatever.
Yeah, you can absolutely love this stuff and still appreciate it. I mean, if you look at, oh, I don't know, let's say Harvey Kurtzman doing the, you know, old comic version of Mad, right? And you'd have Super Duper Man. Well, that, you know, that wasn't saying, oh, there's nothing worth reading about Superman. It's just having a little fun with it. So, yeah, I think most people get that.
So Twilight Guardian is obviously not a fan of these pitches because she throws them all in the trash can. And
which really, if this happened in the real world, you know, I don't know. In my case, I think I'd keep them. I might say no to them, but I might still keep them. But yeah, she does toss them, which I found interesting. Even though I wrote it, I found it interesting.
Would you keep them out of a collector mentality or?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm a pack rat. I've still got, you know, I've got bills from my utilities from like 8 years ago. So yeah, I almost certainly would have them, but there may have been something so intrinsically against her way of thinking about herself that she didn't even want to really consider this kind of stuff. I don't know.
Before she goes out on her patrol, she gets back from her patrol. She takes off, and at the end of the book, she comes back in and she meets somebody, which she's not sure how to react to meeting this person.
Yeah. let's see. How do we talk about this?
We can either talk spoilers and I can garble it up, or we can talk spoilers and people can decide whether or not they want to avoid them.
Sure. Let's do that. Let's just let's make sure that we give everybody a spoiler warning in case they haven't read it yet. And if you haven't read it yet, what the hell is your problem? but yeah, so big spoiler warning here. It would be the end of the third issue, I guess. Her father shows up, and he apparently has been gone since she was just a little girl. And there's a whole set of circumstances behind that that she's never known about. She gets kind of the story of it from her mother. And then a short time later, her father shows up in her apartment. He knows that she's Twilight Guardian, and he explains the full story of what's gone on. This gets complicated because, like everything else in the book, you don't know what to believe. I mean, I've set up the book in such a way, everything is told from her point of view, and we do know that she has some mental problems, so the question becomes how much of this is necessarily real. I've heard a number of people speculate now that he does not show up. He's not in her house. That he, you know, this is all something she's concocted in her mind. I'm not going to say anything about that as to whether or not that's true. I will say it's entirely possible if you look at the way things happen there, because there's no one else around. No one else has seen him. As it happens, he is the artist for a number of the books that she grew up with and has loved,
yeah.
Including The Marvelous Mantelope, which is one of her favorite comics. So the question, you know, you could say, well, what are the odds that she would love these comics so much and her father, her long-lost father, turns out to be the guy who drew them? Yeah, it could be an amazing coincidence. It could be the fact that when she was growing up, he would read comics to her. So maybe that's what got her interested. Could be a lot of things. But again, the question becomes, you know, what can we believe from that scene?
I like the fact that it's open-ended because it makes you mull over it and think and you can't. The fact that it's not cut and dry forces you to not draw an immediate conclusion and think about what's going on in the book and the themes of the book. She's trying to fill a void because she's with this imaginary kind of conspiracy theory father because she feels alone, as she mentioned while she was on the Madeline Island. Or is this just her father regretting having been away and all that? So, yeah, I like it. I like that it's open-ended like that.
Yeah, it's, you know, that was kind of a tough call because, as I said, the book is partially set up as a mystery. And, you know, as I said, her boyfriend has disappeared. The question becomes, where did he go? Did he just move away? And since she's an ex, he didn't bother telling her. Is it a matter of maybe her father, who we know, if he actually is there, he's been watching her. So is it possible maybe he was somehow responsible? Because we've already been told that he might have been responsible for the disappearance of a number of people years ago. Is it possible there's an allusion in there to her mother maybe not being quite all there? So maybe insanity, you know, is running in the family. There are periods there where Twilight Guardian has blackouts, and we don't necessarily know what happened to her during that time. So there's even possibly a suggestion that she had something to do with this. And that, again, that kind of ties into the whole theory of what is a superhero. If, in fact, she does superheroic things and she really positively affects people's lives, then is she not a hero because potentially she may have also done something really villainous? I guess all of that's in there. But, yeah, her father appearing is kind of a pivotal moment for a lot of reasons.
You spoke that should her father be real, he would have been the writer of one of the comics she collects called The Gulch. And it's a black and white comic about a character who espouses the writer's objectivist leanings. And I couldn't help but think if this was maybe inspired by Ditko and his Mr. A character.
Yeah, the Gulch thing, it's a direct homage to Mr. A, to Ditko's Mr. A. I have to tell you, Jason, that the Gulch stuff and the people's reaction to the Gulch so far has been the most fascinating and in a lot of ways the most rewarding part of this miniseries, because it's worked out really well for me in a lot of ways just because of what I was trying to do. The reason that the Gulch is in there, we see two pages from the comic. The reason that it's in there is initially was because I knew that I wanted to have her father possibly being this comic artist. And the Ditko thing came immediately to mind. I mean, Steve Ditko, whose work I absolutely love, he's pretty much lived, you know, as a recluse since the, I don't know, probably the 60s. He hasn't really done conventions and the like since then. And he's, you know, he has an objectivist philosophy, and that's what Mr. A was. So it seemed natural to, since I knew I was going to, you know, want to put more comic pages in issue 4, just like I have every other issue, it became natural to tie that into why her father disappeared, you know, and kind of make him sort of a Ditko-esque character who's sort of, at least in his mind, persecuted because of his objectivist philosophy. And so that all just worked perfectly. Now, it also became interesting because since Twilight Guardian, with the pilot season issue when that came out, because it's all told from her point of view through her journals, a lot of people made the comparison to Rorschach from Watchmen, who does the same thing. Now, this became fascinating to me as well, obviously, because Rorschach is based on Ditko's objectivist heroes, primarily The Question. Although, you know, Rorschach takes it farther toward objectivism than The Question really ever did. So he, in a lot of ways, he's more like Mr. A. And this is where we start talking, you know, metafiction and the like again. The whole concept of having the Gulch in there, I found, is sort of like a Rorschach test for the reader. Mm-hmm. Because I found people reading all sorts of things in that. I'm in the process of writing an article about it because I think it's kind of fascinating. But within a 24-hour period, I had people accusing me of either A, trying to really preach my objectivist philosophy, Or conversely, people saying, how dare you make fun of the objectivist philosophy that Steve Ditko had?
So it was a very galvanizing...
Well, yeah, it just polarized people, and it which fascinated me. And it's interesting to me because there are a lot of aspects of objectivism that yeah, I do agree with. But I didn't put it in the comic for that reason. It's in the comic for literary reasons, right? But that's not necessarily how people saw this. So it tended to be people thinking, well, gee, you know, this must be in there for, you know, because you're trying to put forth some sort of political notion. Well, this was the last issue of the series. I'm not going to suddenly just start throwing politics into it. This would make no sense. But I just found it fascinating how people responded to it. And I personally, I love those two pages in there with the Gulch. I was fairly pleased with myself, the way that I think I was able to capture the Ditko style of writing, which is not an easy thing to do.
Really? It's, that struck me, the very wordy and, like you say, almost preachy, way the characters, speak while fighting. I haven't read the Mr. A stories, but I have read Ditko's early Question work, and it did remind me of that stuff.
Yeah, the Mr. A stuff, I personally love it. And I think even if you do not agree with the philosophy of it, you can still think it's absolutely magnificent. And the reason for that is it is, and you don't see this that much in comics, especially comics that have kind of a superhero bent to them. But it was absolutely a pure work of art. It was Ditko attempting to do a particular thing, and since he didn't have to work with any editor, he created exactly what he wanted to do.
Yeah, very and, sincere.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, but it became tough, you know, as I said, I had to try to ape that style. And if you look at the Mr. A stuff, it was so word-heavy that literally there would be times when you'd have a character in a panel and the word balloons would cover, like, all but, you know, his eyes and nose.
And apparently he would even open some of the stories with just essays.
Yeah, kind of. It was a little bit, it didn't take it this far, but it was a little bit like when Steve Gerber in the 70s was doing Man Thing, and he would have whole pages of just text, and he would have, like, an image, like a one-page shot sort of ghost imaged against the text. So you'd still be getting artwork. But it was really a whole page of text. But that was a real challenge for me because, you know, there are people who could look at, say, Ditko's artwork or Jack Kirby's artwork and duplicate what they did, or at least enough to, you know, close enough for jazz. But if you try to duplicate Ditko's writing or Kirby's writing, they were both so out there in terms of the way that they wrote things that it becomes a lot more challenging. You almost cannot outdo them, you know, because especially if you're going to do something that's sort of a little bit of a parody, you know, you want to exaggerate things, and you almost cannot exaggerate things.
They're already exaggerated.
Yeah, there's now almost no way to take it farther than they did. But but that's what the Gulch was all about. And it just, I don't know, like I said, I was very happy with it. Sid Codian, who drew the book, I thought he did a really nice job of capturing a Ditko-like style, and we did those couple of pages in black and white, as that's how Mr. A was done, mm-hmm. And which also reflects the nature of objectivism and, you know, good versus evil kind of stuff. But
speaking of the art, I thought Sid did a pretty good job too of aping the not just the Ditko stuff, but the panel compositions of the different eras, the coloring was well done too, which very much added to the flavor of the different parodies and the different eras that we see in the book. So I was pretty impressed with the versatility of the art team there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting thing because, you know, Sid, I don't think Sid's a very old guy. And, I mean, to me, he's, you know, probably a fetus. But you know, he really is able to capture that stuff. And it's an interesting thing because I can guarantee you he probably some of the stuff that I made references to he had never seen before. But after, you know, just taking a look at it for a little while, he was really able to capture it. So it was great. And then Bill Farmer did the coloring and just did a fantastic job with it. I was just amazed. There were all kinds of things where, you know, we wanted to get the look like for the old comics and things, and he'd suggest, hey, let's do it this way, and, you know, this is going to simulate the kind of space dot pattern that comics used to use, and it just, it came out really well. And even with the stuff that's not, you know, not references to old comics, if you look at the fourth issue, there's a scene with, you know, with a fire, and the way that that is, both of those guys, both Sid and Bill, just did such a phenomenal job on that. I could not have been happier with it. It's a real pivotal moment for the series, and really the closest thing we get in all four issues to a quote unquote more kind of conventional superhero, you know, sort of scene. But it was just done beautifully. So I'm really hoping at some point, even if it's not on Twilight Guardian, maybe I can work with those guys again, because they, both of them should, I don't know, they should be getting just tons and tons of work, and I hope that they do.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that scene you referenced to, the fire, which was an absolutely stunning way of ending the book, because for the most part, the book has no action. It's fairly mundane, despite it being interesting. The only action we have is in the comic books that Twilight Guardian reads, and it's very, I suppose, cartoony or exaggerated action. And then for the entirety of the book, we see Twilight Guardian sort of invent crimes that she's monitoring, like this lady's talking to her parrot, so she's concerned she may be involved in a parrot prostitution ring and that sort of thing. But, and we are left wondering, like, is anything going to happen in that sense? And I've heard that said in podcasts and in reviews, it's strange because it's interesting, but nothing happens. But something most definitely happens that prompts Twilight Guardian to do something that we would consider conventionally heroic at the end of the series.
Well, that part of the reason I wanted to do that, it is because I basically, because nothing happens in the series, I wanted to have any action that did happen just be like just at the very end, just make it, you know, really as kind of quick as I could. It partially came out of this. There's kind of a notion that, at least in my head, the way that the real world works is really pretty amazing, and it's much quirkier than people think that it is. And I'm reminded when I'm talking about this stuff, there was DC used to have a series called Wasteland, and I'm not sure if a lot of people these days necessarily ever would have read it. It was a fascinating book. It was ostensibly a horror comic, but it was very odd. It was not conventional horror in the sense that we think of horror comics. And there was a story in there. I think it was probably written by the late Del Close. I could be wrong, but I think he wrote, I think, the mainstay of the stuff in the book. And there was a story in there that was absolutely fascinating. And it was about a guy, if I recall. It's been a long time since I've read it, but much like my own Tales of the Pathetic Club series, the story had it dealt with OCD, and which Twilight Guardian, as we mentioned, probably also has. But there's a guy in this particular story from Wasteland who becomes convinced every day he goes to work, and he has to leave work and he has to go home because he's become convinced that his bed is on fire. And so this happens. It happens time and again. He's in danger of losing his job, right? But he every day becomes convinced, oh, my God, I have to go home. My bed's on fire. And so what happens is one day he goes home and his bed is on fire, which sounds crazy. But, you know, it's amazing because real life sometimes works that way. So, you know, in my head, I think I was thinking in those terms a little bit. So even in Twilight Guardian's mundane life, you know, just like in the rest of our mundane lives, occasionally there's going to be some sort of a moment of whatever, whether it's a miracle, whether it's something that's just so quirky, you know. I mean, there are times in our lives when maybe one day, you know, you're outside, you're taking out the trash, and then inexplicably, you know, you never would have thought about it 24 hours earlier, but the next day you're, you know, in a hot air balloon over France. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, and it sounds like the stuff that fiction is made of, but sometimes it actually happens. So I kind of had this idea in my head that maybe that sort of thing was, you know, was going on. So maybe in the last issue, something happens that, even though the book is set up to be very realistic, maybe something's going to happen that, while still within the realm of possibility, is going to, you know, really be something the reader is not expecting. And it worked out nicely for me because, as we were talking about before, you had people who were saying, well, really, there's not much happening in this book. Yeah, I'm enjoying it, but there's not really anything going on. Now, I would disagree with that. I think there's a lot going on in the book. But, you know, there's a reference in the first issue to this lady who leaves her Christmas lights up all the time. In fact, we saw her in the pilot season issue. And there's a scene in the first issue of the miniseries where Twilight Guardian notices that the Christmas light wiring is frayed, and she's worried that it might be a fire hazard. And, you know, people commented on that, and they said, well, you know, that's not really, there's nothing going on there. That's not heroic. She's noticing, you know, that there's this possible fire hazard. And, of course, in the fourth issue, the house catches fire. Mm-hmm. So it's much like, the burning bed. So, you know, had she done something, had she been able to do something about the frayed wiring in issue one, would that have been a superheroic action? Because she would have prevented this fire from happening. And she attempted to, although she feels like she could have done more. So then it becomes a question of, okay, well, the house is on fire now. What's going to happen? Uh-huh. And it becomes an interesting moment in the series because up until now, you could assume that she's just this crazy woman who fancies herself a superhero. But
does not dare do anything heroic.
Sure. But then suddenly, without hesitation, she goes into the burning house. So I'm not sure at that point anyone could argue that she's not as much a superhero as anyone else in comics. And then immediately after that, and I wanted it to be, you know, Twilight Guardian, because nothing happens, there's no fight scenes. And this just drives people crazy. I can tell you this. I don't know how many people, including the people who just love the comic, they just can't get over the fact that, wait a minute, there are no fight scenes. And it just, in a way, it makes me a little bit sad because what that says is we've become so conditioned to this being the case, you know. It'd be kind of like if people were saying, well, wait a minute, how can this movie be a Western? There's not a gunfight. You know, so that it becomes an interesting way of thinking. So, and then we have the scene where she finally meets her supposed archenemy, the Dusk Devil, who she's talked about from the beginning of the book, and of course he's not what she's imagined. And that gets into a whole other area because, and I think I may have mentioned this, there are people who are also saying, wait a minute, maybe this guy was not actually a villain at all, because when we see him, she's just come out of the fire. She's kind of down on her knees a few blocks from where the fire happened. And this guy in a ski mask shows up and, you know, she's telling us that, well, he's trying to, you know, get $5 from me. But we, of course, don't know because there's no dialogue in the panel. It's just her describing it. He reaches down as if to say, OK, give me some money. But he could just as easily be saying, excuse me, can I help you up? And it is Halloween night. So the fact that he's wearing a ski mask, you know, it's not the same as any other day of the year. Either way, she ends up cold cocking him. So, you know, and at this point, we don't know what happens beyond that. She says, well, I'm going to have to stay here while I call the police.
Right. So
but, if we don't know.
If this happens, it will have witnesses. And if it didn't. We'd find out if she's just imagined this or not, but of course the series ends there.
Maybe in the sequel it will entirely take place in prison after she's been arrested for assaulting this poor guy.
Or the asylum.
Possibly.
So that's it for part one. Thanks a lot for listening. And if you haven't already, go to the StashMyComics.com homepage and register a free account with the website. This will allow you to wrangle your comic books collection, organize it by whatever categories you like. You can tag them, search the database, add new books to the database, add images or info about comic books. And as you use StashMyComics.com, when you contribute to the database, you will be awarded points, which you can redeem for tickets in one of our many and excellent giveaways. So check out the homepage of StashMyComics.com for more information. And until next time, may the force be with you. Live long and prosper. Excelsior.